You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of August, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Martin, what are we looking at today?
Well, Egypt with President Mubarak back in court, where's that going? Zimbabwe after the election. And slavery, what kind of compensation should the Caribbean get from Britain?
Excellent stuff, Martin. Also on the program is Ethiopia, the new Bangladesh for the clothing industry. We'll wonder why H&M is sending part of its production away from Asia to the Horn of Africa.
Plus, we'll continue scrolling through the sections of Monocle's September issue. Today, we'll reflect on the best places to think around the world. NYU's Department of Philosophy is a good place to start.
I think the undergraduate students are particularly engaged here. There's something about the group of students who sort of self-select themselves to come to
right.
New York in the heart of Greenwich Village as
right.
opposed to, you know, ivied walls.
And,
and we'll meet two brothers who chose to make a business out of their mother's home-cooked cream puffs.
What you fill your puff pastry with is what counts, and a lot of people do just custard, or a lot of people just do a straight up whipped cream. And what our mom's recipe does is it combines custard and cream in kind of a special way.
All that, plus we'll check in with our Madrid correspondent. We'll leaf through the Italian front pages, and we'll even play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes up ahead, but before all that, here is Mr. Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The editor of the British newspaper The Guardian has revealed that the government forced the paper to destroy material leaked by the US security whistleblower Edward Snowden. Alan Rusbridger was also critical of the decision to hold the Brazilian David Miranda at Heathrow Airport for 9 hours on Sunday. Mr. Miranda is the partner of The Guardian journalist Glenn Greenwald, who wrote most of the stories about US secret surveillance based on material leaked by Edward Snowden. Alan Rusbridger says the government has used terrorism laws to inhibit journalism, but Home Secretary Theresa May disagrees.
I think it's right, given that it is the first duty of the government to protect the public, that if the police believe somebody has in their possession highly sensitive, stolen information which could help terrorists, which could lead to a loss of lives, then it is right that the police act, and that's what the law enables them to do. But of course the law also has safeguards within it, and we have an independent reviewer who, as he has already said, David Anderson has already said, he will be looking into this case to ensure that it was conducted properly.
European Union governments will today discuss how to use their economic muscle to force Egypt's army-backed rulers to end a crackdown on the deposed President Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood. There may be little they can do to inflict hardship on Cairo by cutting back on aid, because much of their cash goes to civil society groups, not the government, and Saudi Arabia has pledged to fill any shortfall if support is stopped. The bloc's 28 governments are likely to tread carefully, mixing expressions of concern over bloodshed with limited, if any, changes in the €5 billion aid package Europe promised to Egypt last year. Opposition activists in Syria are claiming dozens of people have died in chemical weapons attacks in a region east of Damascus. They're saying rockets carrying toxic agents were launched in the Ghouta region early on Wednesday. And the UN Refugee Agency says the government of Iraqi Kurdistan is struggling to cope with the flood of refugees crossing the border from Syria. Local authorities have set an entry quota of 3,000 refugees a day, but there are signs many more are still coming in. UNHCR officials are reported to have told an internal UN meeting in Baghdad on Monday that up to 100,000 Syrian refugees could be expected to flee to Iraq within the next month if the current pace continues. Erdovan Kalkan of UNHCR in Dohuk.
Since 15th of August, the Kurdistan regional government has opened the border for refugees coming from Syria. The first day, more than 7,000 people streamed to the border.
Three teenage boys have been charged over the killing of an Australian university student in Oklahoma. Prosecutors say they carried out the killing for the fun of it. Christopher Lane from Melbourne was found dead of a gunshot wound on Friday, according to police in Duncan, about 80 miles south of Oklahoma City. 16-year-old Chauncey Luna, and James Edwards Jr., who's 15, are charged with first-degree murder. 17-year-old Michael Jones, who allegedly drove the vehicle carrying the other suspects, was charged with use of a vehicle and the discharge of a weapon and accessory to murder after the fact. Jones has named Luna as the gunman. Jason Hicks is the Stevens County District Attorney.
I would tell you I'm a longtime resident of Stevens County, and I am appalled at the behavior of these three children. I think it is something that this community can certainly do without, and I know the entire community is upset, disappointed to see something like this happen here.
Attorneys defending a Guantanamo prisoner charged in the 9/11 plot have asked for restrictions on the way the CIA can use private information generated by defense lawyers. Previous discussions of classified information in the Guantanamo War Crimes Tribunal have focused on defense lawyers' responsibility to safeguard information collected by the government. Defense lawyers said that without new limits, they could be co-opted as intelligence gatherers for the CIA. Astronomers in Chile have captured the violent birth of a new star some 1,400 light-years from Earth, revealing close-up the energetic burst of glowing gas that power new stars. Amazing footage has revealed the star's birth as it ejects material into space at supersonic speeds as high as 1 million kilometres an hour, colliding with space dust and debris. The images of the creation of a new star in the constellation Vela were captured by the European Southern Observatory's ALMA telescope in Chile. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Well, it's 6 minutes past the hour now. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres,
Holanda,
London, Europe,
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. It's time now to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Martin Plaut. He's a fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies. Martin, welcome to the show. The crisis in Egypt continues to deepen. What can you bring us up to date with?
Well, today we have the return to court of President Mubarak, who was, of course, overthrown in 2011. It's his fourth court case, this time facing corruption charges. Now, his lawyer is trying to get him released from jail and released on bail. He argues that all this one is apparently about corruption. The previous ones were allegations that he had shot protesters or ordered the shooting of protesters. This one's about corruption. And the lawyer is now turning around saying, well, you know, he paid back $600,000 in gifts that he received. So, you know, he should be allowed to go. But I mean, of course, this is just the absolute tip of the iceberg, because, I mean, you know, this is a powder keg, and, you know, how they're going to get around this is difficult to see.
And we're also seeing, of course, the arrest of the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, the aptly named Mahmoud Abadi.
Well, indeed, you know, this was seen as something of a red line, that they wouldn't go and actually arrest him. And when it was shown on television with sort of triumphal music, I think a shudder must have gone through Egyptian society. Because, you know, whatever one thinks about the Muslim Brotherhood, one shouldn't forget just how deep their roots are. You know, this is a movement rather like some of the movements in Gaza and in Lebanon, which have very deep roots, because they go back to a process of giving out assistance to the poor. And that is how they built their support, was on the state was incapable of helping people. They went, they gave out assistance, they gave education, they gave food, they ran clinics. And that is why they were loved for many years. But of course, then when they came to power, it was a different story.
And you mentioned, of course, there when the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood was put on television, they had a banner as well, which state television put up, saying fighting terrorists. Many people now looking at the situation will go, this is just going back to the ways of the old Mubarak regime. His military buddies are now back in power. The case against Mubarak is essentially collapsing. They're rounding up all these Muslim Brotherhood leaders. Is this just going back to square one again?
Well, I don't think one ever goes back to square one. You know, history repeats itself first time as tragedy, second time as farce, as Marx said. But, you know, in essence, I think the question for the Muslim Brotherhood is, which way do you go? Do you now retreat into your heartlands, into the rural and urban poor, or do you begin to take up weapons? And that is a huge decision that they have to take. And there is some suggestion that they are being told, look, go down the Turkish route. When the Turkish government removed the army, removed the elected president, the Islamists basically held their fire. In Algeria, it was the other way around.
Absolutely. There was a democratically elected Islamic government in Algeria. They were overthrown by the military in 1991. They chose to fight, and they had a very long and deadly civil war.
It was 10 years of civil war, tens of thousands of people dead, and the FIS, which was the movement which won the election in 91, has never recovered and is in complete disarray, while is in Turkey, of course, the Islamists are in control.
And this is something that the current al-Qaeda leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is Egyptian, you know, he's long been prophesizing, what's the point of electing governments? Look what happened to Algeria in 1991, and now look what's happened in Egypt.
Well, it's made their case, hasn't it, in a way. But I mean, you know, would he ever have liked a democratically elected government of any stripe? So, I mean, you know, really, I don't take that position terribly seriously.
And looking at the wider region, at the peace talks between Israel and Palestine, I mean, I think Israel is now bringing pressure to bear, aren't they, saying that this may strongly jeopardise talks?
Well, indeed. But I mean, you know, when do the Israelis really want talks ever to go ahead? So I wouldn't, you know, really, where was that ever going? I mean, you know, it's a tragedy. There's one element that perhaps we haven't come across, which is that, are you aware that there's a huge row between South Africa and Egypt? Because the South Africans called it a coup, which the Egyptians, of course, hate the term. And the Egyptians have now come back and saying, we are surprised that South Africa is trying to export its failed reconciliation process and pointing out that it has some of the worst crime rates, corruption, poverty in the world. So a huge row broken out between Cairo and Pretoria.
Fascinating stuff, Martin. Let's move on, though, to Zimbabwe. Morgan Tsvangirai facing court charges.
Well, yes, this is sort of bringing the judiciary into disrepute for suggesting that there wasn't much difference between the judges who were appointed by Mugabe and ZANU-PF, which is his party. Well, you know, I'm afraid, you know, Mugabe, I think, is going to throw everything he has at Morgan Tsvangirai. Of course, I always just wonder, and, you know, Georgina, you're from Zimbabwe. Do you think there's any chance that Mugabe would decide to go for a unity government now and try and bring in Tsvangirai as a sort of, you know, the small brother?
You know, I do. I absolutely do. I think Mugabe would see that as some kind of form of legitimacy, that it would be like a government of national unity light, as they've done before.
Yes.
I think what's going to happen, though, is at the moment the MDC face a very difficult challenge, which is, do they take up their seats in a parliament that they're saying is not legitimate? If they take up their seats, obviously they're giving it their seal of approval. And I think the problem there is that some members of the party, particularly those in the south of the country, have felt marginalised for so long. They've won their seats legitimately, they believe, and very much want to go into parliament. It's also a question of salaries. It really does come down to the basics. MPs, they do get paid peanuts. However, they need those peanuts to survive. So what happens next is going to be very, very
Absolutely.
Interesting.
And of course, the African Union supporting the election, supporting Mugabe. So an interesting divide. Of course, the Americans continuing their sanctions on Zimbabwe, refusing to lift them.
Not on Zimbabwe. Careful. They've never had sanctions against Zimbabwe. It's always been on the regime and on members of the regime. The regime turns around and says it's against the whole of Zimbabwe. It's not. It's against individuals.
As you say, the AU actually going along with it. And we're going to see Mugabe inaugurated tomorrow.
Oh, that's going to be fun. And of course, the other thing is that the whole of Southern Africa, I mean, there's a wonderful headline from one of the South African papers saying, Southern Africa dances the Mugabe victory jig. He's got the support of the region. What more does he want?
Well,
and very quickly, Martin, let's move on to a third story, which you highlighted for us. And that, of course, is a continuing struggle for compensation for slavery in the Caribbean.
Indeed. You know, the Caribbean countries, the 14 CARICOM countries, have asked lawyers in Britain to call for reparations to be paid by Britain, France and the Netherlands to the Caribbean for what happened under slavery. They point out that millions were paid to the slave owners when slavery was ended in the 19th century. But nothing was given to the slaves. And they're saying, we want the equivalent that they got, which was about $200 billion. Now, whether they'll get that is not clear. But clearly they begin to press and they're saying, well, look what happened to the Mau Mau. They got compensation. Why shouldn't we?
And interestingly, they're using exactly the same firm of lawyers that got that Mau Mau settlement.
Absolutely, Lee Day. Of course, there are other questions one could ask. For example, why should the United States not pay? Because, of course, a lot of the slaves went and worked in the southern plantations. And the other question one should ask is, what about the Arab states? Because everybody forgets that there was as much slavery on the east coast of Africa as there was across the Atlantic. And nobody ever raises that question. And that goes back 5,000 years to 2900 BC. That was when slaves were being taken from Sudan up into Egypt.
Very interesting stuff, and I'm sure a subject that we'll return to. Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, thank you very much for that.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be asking whether Made in Ethiopia will soon become the new Made in China.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibaken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
Now, welcome back. After Bangladesh, Ethiopia is becoming the new low-cost country retailers are turning to for garment production. H&M has announced that it will start sourcing its clothing from the small country in the Horn of Africa. The Swedish giant joins a host of rivals looking for alternatives to areas like southern China, where manufacturing costs are rising.
But Ethiopia isn't a newcomer to the textile and garment industry, and it has aggressive plans for growth in the coming years. Brands like Guess and Tommy Hilfiger are already ordering large-scale production from the country. Well, we'll shortly speak to Professor Christopher Kramer from the School of Oriental and African Studies, who's a specialist in the politics of development in Africa. But first, we're on the line with Jens Hansgaard, who's been following H&M's announcement from the Wall Street Journal's Stockholm Bureau. Jens, thanks for joining us. What sort of figures are we looking at in terms of the amount of production moving to Ethiopia?
This still remains unclear. H&M is a very secretive company, and they're not giving any figures yet. So we don't know, but it'll be, we don't know, quite simply, yet.
And there's some worrying concerns, I guess, on the part of H&M. They just released a couple of days ago their latest July figures, and it showed like-for-like sales over the previous year was down about 1%. Is this starting to highlight a real problem for H&M? Because if you look at the company's structure, 80% of their sales currently are in Europe. When you compare that to a company like Zara, which in a sense is perhaps their largest rival, you know, Zara has a huge amount of potential that they really exploited, I guess you could say, in the developing world, especially in parts like Asia, where they have thousands of stores. H&M necessarily doesn't have that kind of outreach, does it?
No, but that's why also they're reshifting their focus. I mean, their biggest expansion this year and last year will be China and the U.S. So they're moving away from Europe to moving away from flat sales in Europe.
Is it also, I mean, could one say that they're doing it from an altruistic point of view? Is there a genuine feeling there within the company that they do want to help development in Africa, that they're looking to looking at employment creation and so on?
Well, perhaps. I mean, they are, when you talk to NGOs, they say that, when I've talked to NGOs who are active in Bangladesh, they say that H&M seems very sincere, and compared to other companies, they're doing a lot of good work. I mean, they have they've supported the growing textiles industry in Bangladesh by creating jobs and by putting pressure on the government to improve building safety and fire safety. So perhaps, yeah.
And Jens, the founders of the company, the Pearson family, which owns about 43% of the company. Now, the current structure is essentially debt-free. Are there plans to reinvest in the company to do what exactly you said there and expand perhaps a bit more vigorously around the world?
Yeah, they have a constant target. They have some 3,000 stores today, and they H&M grows its number of stores by some 10% to 15% every year. So that's why, you know, that's why they have to increase, make sure that shelves are stacked, and that's why they're increasing purchasing both in Asia, where they make most of their stuff today, but also looking at countries like Ethiopia.
Well, do you think they're perhaps expanding a bit too quickly? Because if they are having this problem, at least here in Europe, where they're having declining shares, could they risk going a bit out a bit too hard?
No. I mean, their business model is expansion, quite simply. That's the driving thing for them, expanding the number of stores. And the target is set, and they've kept at it for forever, basically.
What do people in Sweden think about this?
About what?
About H&M now moving, a very Swedish company now moving into the Horn of Africa.
H&M is a very popular company in Sweden. So, and it is generally believed that, I think you were mentioning before, some sort of altruistic. They say, I think the Swedish idea is that H&M is better than other companies in that perspective.
Thank you very much to you, Jens. Now, unfortunately, we can't get Christopher on the line just at the moment, so we're going to leave that there. But very interesting story, Phil. I think it's one that is going to develop, and it'll be very interesting to see if other companies follow suit.
Absolutely.
and move into the region.
And it has been interesting to see how H&M's business model has slightly changed. You know, earlier, I think it was just about 18 months ago, they launched a more upscale offshoot of H&M called Other Stories, which were aimed at, a higher market for young women. Of course, in the past couple of years, they've recruited some very high-profile celebrities to sell their brand. Of course, David Beckham, perhaps one of the best-known brand ambassadors for the company. I think his latest underwear line launches in just a couple of days as well. So, H&M really trying to diversify their portfolio of companies, and it'll be interesting to see how this shift to Africa in terms of production and just how much they actually how much stuff will actually be coming out of Africa. It could be potentially a very interesting business story for us.
I see that Beckham kept his trousers on in these latest adverts, though.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens in the next couple of days. Up next, we'll continue our delve into Monocle Magazine's September issue. Today, we're looking at the culture section, and we'll get a bit philosophical.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 24 minutes past the hour. Well, all week we've been looking at the latest edition of the magazine, issue 66 for September, which is on newsstands now. Today we flick through the culture section in search of an inspiring environment to let our minds wander. Monocle's Pauline Eiferman went to find a place to think.
We're on the top floor of New York University's Department of Philosophy, an unassuming building with a well-kept secret. After a quick introduction in his office, Professor Don Garrett opens a door, revealing a bright ray of warm, multicolored light running from the skylight to the floor. The Tower of Light, as architect Stephen Hall calls the staircase, was designed as the centerpiece of the building. Geometrical steps with seemingly random treads and landings rest against a brick wall, coated with thick white paint. Daylight shines through the strips of prismatic film glued on large windows, creating rainbows that stretch across the walls. Inspired by Ludwig Wittgenstein, Stephen Hall created a black and white interior with the implication of color through reflection and refraction.
So when we get the sun coming through, you'll get rainbows on the white walls here.
Rushing down the staircase, a graceful PhD student holds a cup of coffee full to the brim. Her name is Asia Pacinski, and she just started teaching her first class, Aesthetics and the Philosophy of Art.
It's my first time teaching, and it's the second week of my course.
Awesome.
And students seem really into it, and I have really terrific students. I think maybe because the Tisch School is really good at NYU, and so I have a lot of people who aren't really philosophers,
right,
but they're artists themselves and are super interested in art, and they've really been thinking about a lot of these questions on their own for a long time.
That's really interesting.
They're super excited and really engaged, and it's really fun teaching people like that.
The philosophy department, considered by many as the best in the world, consists of 23 professors and 41 PhD candidates. About 150 undergraduate students major in philosophy every year, but for most NYU freshmen, it's the first time philosophy enters their world. So many end up taking introductory classes as electives by curiosity.
I think the undergraduate students are particularly engaged here. There's something about the group of students who sort of self-select themselves to come to New York in the heart of Greenwich Village as opposed to, ivied walls and cloistered quads. They're very lively and very engaged.
The trend in philosophy is to be increasingly integrated with other disciplines. Professor Garrett recently served on the dissertation committee of an art student interested in Spinoza and his relation to the history of music. Many of the students here today come from other departments, but are considering making philosophy their minor. Ashwin Malia is an economics major taking the Ethics of Medicine class.
I decided to take a philosophy course this summer because I did my first philosophy course last semester, and I wanted to do something this summer because we have like really long summer holidays, like 4 months. So I was like, I might as well just take a class or something. And I was thinking of maybe I might like minor in philosophy. I'm an econ major and a math minor. So I'm not doing the philosophy minor in the sense that it's going to help me in the future, because I don't know if people even look at it as like helpful, but like I like the subject in the sense that it helps you like think clearly. I mean, it's like people like criticize philosophy for like the subject material, but it's not like the subject material itself. It's like you're forced to like think about stuff in like a very like critical and analytical way, and like you're not supposed to like let your emotions get into it. And I kind of like that way of thinking and structure.
These are great skills to learn, says Nick Riggle, a final year PhD student who teaches introductory classes to undergraduates. In a few weeks, he'll be defending his dissertation called The Self and the Aesthetic. He says being in New York and in this building was a great inspiration. Though like any philosopher, he also has some reservations.
I genuinely think it's beautiful to look at. I mean, if you're walking, especially at night, if you're walking down Mercer, you see this building. It's wonderful because the way he designed it is, you can actually follow the line of that wall all the way through the building from the outside.
Oh, right.
And it's all lit up. So it just looks really wonderful. I think it's beautiful to look at and sort of walk through.
Yeah.
But as a place where one works every day, it's not the best. There's not enough opportunity for like spontaneous community.
Professor Garrett disagrees, explaining there's more to the building than meets the eye. As our conversation nears its end, it's clear to see he's thought quite a bit about the hidden meanings. Could the black and white furniture point to right and wrong? He ponders with a smile, leaving the rest up to our interpretation. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
Now, a little further down the culture section of our September issue, Tom Hall reports on Fairfield International, a promising new art school and a convenient escape away from the noise of the city.
Set to begin welcoming its first six residents in September 2014, Fairfield International, a new art school helmed by UK contemporary artist Ryan Gander, will soon bring the artist's enthusiasm for meditative work filtered through a playful sense of the what-if to the small Suffolk village of Saxmundham. Though its setting might be an idyllic artist's escape, population 3,500, conveniently located 2 hours train ride from the nearby art market Monster of London, there's nothing self-serving about the philanthropic ideals of Fairfield. By next year, the century-old former primary school will be extended to an exhibition hall, arts library, sculpture garden with glass-covered courtyard and cafe available for public use, all created with the simple aim of helping young artists with no previous profile become self-sufficient. And Gander has clear ideas about where new artists' upkeep should be coming from. In the new edition of Monocle, he says, "It seems logical that in an era when arts education seems solely for the middle and upper classes, that the main players in the art world invest back into promoting pioneering talent. Gander's own art, which ranges from sculpture to writing and installations that delve in and out of almost their not-quite-right realities, pushes for engagement and a bit of back and forth from its viewers." Soon, his new school will be adding to the conversation.
And that was Monocle's Tom Hall there, and you are listening to Midori House.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll check in with our Madrid correspondent, Liam Alduis. We'll read through the Italian front pages, and we'll meet two brothers whose mother's cooking has inspired them to start their own company.
What you fill your puff pastry with is what counts, and a lot of people will do just custard, or a lot of people just do a straight up whipped cream. And what our mom's recipe does is it combines custard and cream in kind of a special way.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The editor of the British newspaper The Guardian has revealed that the government forced it to destroy material leaked by the US security whistleblower Edward Snowden. Alan Rusbridger was also critical of the decision to hold the Brazilian David Miranda at Heathrow Airport for 9 hours on Sunday. Mr. Miranda is the partner of the Guardian journalist who reported on Mr. Snowden's leaked material. European Union governments will today discuss how to use their economic muscle to force Egypt's army-backed rulers to end a crackdown on the deposed President Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood. Opposition activists in Syria are claiming dozens of people have died in chemical weapons attacks in a region east of Damascus. They say rockets carrying toxic agents were launched in the Ghouta region early on Wednesday. Three teenage boys have been charged over the killing of an Australian university student in Oklahoma. Prosecutors say they carried out the killing for the fun of it. Chris Lane from Melbourne was found dead of a gunshot wound on Friday, according to police in Duncan, about 80 miles south of Oklahoma City. Attorneys defending a Guantanamo prisoner charged in the 9/11 plot have asked for restrictions on the way the CIA can use private information generated by defence lawyers. The lawyers say that without new limits, they could be co-opted as intelligence gatherers for the CIA. Astronomers in Chile have captured the violent birth of a new star some 1,400 light-years from Earth, revealing close-up the energetic bursts of glowing gas that power new stars. Images of the creation of a new star in the constellation Vela were captured with the European Southern Observatory's ALMA telescope in Chile. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn. This week on The Entrepreneurs, we're treating our sweet tooth over in San Francisco.
Yum, yum. Now, as youngsters, brothers Reese and Trent Carvath were in love with their mother's home-cooked cream puffs. So when they decided to start a business, they didn't have to think too hard about what they wanted to sell. Monocle San Francisco correspondent Alistair G reports on how they built a successful company despite opening Pacific Puffs when the economy took a nosedive.
At Pacific Puffs, a shop selling cream puffs on Union Street in San Francisco's Tony Marina district, customers are savoring the handmade treats.
Yum. The best.
Despite being founded in 2009, at the height of the recession, Pacific Puffs has prospered and is a demonstration of how, with the right product, and in particular with the right recipe, you can make a go of it, whatever the economic climate.
The story is basically a family recipe. Trent and I grew up with our younger brother and older sister eating cream puffs. That is my mom's famous recipe. We had them from the time we were one year old. And we had them for special occasions, Christmas, birthdays, all grown up. It was our favorite dessert.
That's Reese Carvolf, one of the two-brother team behind Pacific Puffs. Trent, at 31, is 3 years his senior, and also only has fond memories of their mother's dessert.
As we were growing up, she really perfected it because we asked her to make cream puffs so often.
When it comes to puffs, What most of the customers at Union Street comment on is not the dough or the topping, but what's inside. Reese says that this is for good reason.
What you fill your puff pastry with is what counts, and a lot of people will do just custard, or, you know, to make a profiterole, do kind of an ice cream filling, or a lot of people just do a straight up whipped cream. And what our mom's recipe does is it combines custard and cream in kind of a special way to create a really kind of unique pastry cream that's really good.
At the store, customers come and go, often ordering a dozen puffs at a time.
I just want a dozen.
Dozen? Mini size?
No. Regular
size?
Yeah.
Okay. And just an assortment of them? Or?
Half chocolate, half vanilla.
Watching it all from a table at the front, Reese recalls how the company got started. He and his brother were both sick of being stuck in corporate America.
We were both in cubicles working with spreadsheets. I was working at Dow Jones doing venture capital research, and Trent was at eSurance doing marketing. So very typical 9-to-5 kind of rat race jobs that weren't bad, but we just weren't thrilled about and wanted to, you know, get out of the office, basically.
They had no background in cooking or running their own business. But what they had was that recipe. At first, Trent says, it was a slog.
For about the first 6 to 8 months of the business, Reese still had his day job working at Dow Jones. He had to be at work by about 8:30 in the morning. So we had to have all our production finished by about 7:30. So he had time to get home, take a shower, and then get to work. He would go off to work. I would come and work the store all day here on Union Street. So our mornings usually started about 4 in the morning. So that was a pretty rough startup phase.
Now they've honed the process to the point where they can make several thousand puffs a day, and one of them is still in the kitchen every morning. Much of their success stems from branching out into the food truck scene early on, enabling them to cater to family and corporate events.
All right, so Laura just took down this order. It's Victoria just called in. This is August 24th, food truck event. We would be the only dessert truck there. It's for 600 people in Livermore.
Perfect.
Seeing as they have a foot in both camps, they say that they're unusually attuned to the resentments that crop up between the owners of brick-and-mortar restaurants and food trucks.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, obviously we're huge fans of free market, but it can only be so free. You know, we wouldn't want someone with a competing cream puff truck to pull up in front of our shop right here on Union Street. On the other hand, if they were to pop open 300 yards away, which is what the city stipulates for, I believe, the buffer zone for a truck with a similar concept to your food, then it's just competition. And I would say, you know, we believe in our product, we think it's better than theirs, and people are going to shop at Pacific Puffs and not the truck down the street.
Pacific Puffs currently has 2 shops, 2 trucks, and about 20 people on payroll. One person particularly pleased with their success is their mum, Noreen, who remembers her reaction when Trent first came to her with the idea.
Trent called one day and said, are you and Papa going to be around? I want to come up and talk to you about something. When we sat and listened, Trent's father said, don't quit your day job. And within a month, Trent had quit his day job. So at first, you know, it was at a time that economically things were kind of at a down spiral. And we were somewhat worried, but I have to say that from day one, Pacific Puffs was welcomed, and I don't know whether they told you, but that first day they opened at 11 o'clock and I think they were sold out by 1:30.
Back on Union Street, the lesson from the success of Pacific Puff seems to be that if there's something that you love, you can be fairly confident you'll find other people who love it too. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alastair G.
And that was a preview of this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs. You can tune in tonight at 1900 hours London time for the first airing of that brand new edition. Elsewhere on the show, we'll hear from Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales. We'll discuss entrepreneurship in the Middle East with venture capitalist and internet executive Chris Schroeder. And we'll sit down with our friends at Wink Creative to give clothing retailer Diesel a branding overhaul.
Are you a fan of cream puffs?
Oh, definitely.
Are you?
Can't you tell?
Okay, this is a family show, Georgina. It's 8:39 in the morning. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll be in Madrid to find out why that city is getting filthy dirty.
Oh.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 9:40 in Madrid and 8:40 here in London. And we're headed to Spain next.
Joining us on the line from the Spanish capital is our man there, Liam Aldis. Liam, welcome to the show. Just before the break, I was talking about how Madrid was getting a bit dirty. What can you tell us?
Well, yeah, I have been noticing that the streets in particular are getting dirty and also a little unsafe because there's so many potholes and kind of dislodged paving stones as well. And it became a kind of a pet peeve of mine. But then I found that actually the budget for street repairs and cleaning has actually been reduced over the last 2 years from about 310 million euros to about 167 million euros. So it's actually been drastically reduced, and the results are beginning to show. So there's a lot more rubbish not being collected, particularly in the outer suburbs, and also a lot of big potholes, which are becoming quite dangerous.
And that must be having an impact on the economy in a more wider sense, because, of course, if there's no money going in for street cleaning, people who clean the streets are losing their jobs.
Exactly, and hundreds of people have actually been made redundant. The city council actually renegotiated all the contracts with the cleaning and repair companies and kind of created this, what they call this super contract, which actually just means a lot of austerity being put into place. But a lot of people are complaining, and it's becoming quite, there's a big editorial actually in El País not long ago, and a lot of people complaining. But there was also a few interesting figures saying that they actually have even been removing streetlights. About 17,500 streetlights have been removed, which is saving the city council about 1.9 million euros, but means a lot of suburbs are being left in the dark. And there was also another cleaning measure being put into place. There's news came out today that they're going to put into place tests for street buskers and street performers. So they're trying to clean up the streets as far as music is concerned, but not really worrying about the pavement.
But surely that must add, you know, if you go to a city like Madrid or Barcelona, seeing those kind of street performers out there, you know, it adds such an environment and atmosphere to those cities. Isn't there a concern that they're just going to be stripping away too much too quickly?
Well, I'm concerned, Phil. I'm concerned, particularly because last year Barcelona actually moved its famous human statues to the end of the La Rambla because they said they were blocking traffic. And I said that was a kind of sign that the city is going down more of a conservative path. But now it seems that Madrid is going the same way. And Madrid could have really taken advantage of that and actually made the streets even livelier, just letting people perform, particularly because there's an unemployment crisis. I mean, if you take away people's right to perform on the street, I mean, what can they do?
Well, quality control, though, surely is always a good thing. You don't want a really bad busker, do you?
Well, quality control is important, but I mean, in times like these, I think maybe there's more important things to focus on than whether someone's singing in tune or not. I mean, sometimes a bad busker can be quite entertaining because they're so bad that they're good. So, I mean, the question is, who is deciding on what's good and what's not? That's the question.
And Liam, let's move on to another topic which you brought to our attention. Of course, Spain is well known for its so-called white elephants, especially when it comes to transport and infrastructure projects. Of course, many of us here at Monocle 24 will be familiar with Ciudad Real, of course, this huge airport which was built a few years ago, which has essentially remained completely empty. Spain's north, though, is actually getting a new airport?
Yeah, there's another new airport. And have you ever heard of the town Teruel?
I have not, no. Georgina, have you?
No.
No.
Well, that's all set to change because there has been a new airport built, and they already won up on some of the other airport white elephant projects around Spain because their first Boeing 747 landed last week. And this airport's a little different. It's actually going to be a maintenance airport, and it's set to challenge the U.S. dominance of the MRO, maintenance, repair, and overhaul sector. So the plans are that it's going to house around 250 aircraft, and traditionally European aircraft had to make the journey across the Atlantic for their long-term repairs. So this airport is actually the highest altitude airport in Spain. It's going to actually vie for the contract from Virgin Galactic to be the next suborbital aircraft spaceport as well. So, I mean, this town could go from a small town backwater, which no one ever heard of, to an interplanetary spaceport. So I guess you have to watch this space.
And the people there presumably are very pleased about that.
They're very happy because it's actually going to create quite a lot of employment, about 100 jobs in the short term, which is a huge boost for a small town. And it could put them on the map, so they're quite happy because Teruel is actually often joked about as being one of the towns that no one's ever heard of. It's kind of the deep Spain that no one wants to go to, so this is going to kind of change that.
Well, we'll have to try and buy a ticket on one of those first Virgin Galactic flights, I think, Liam, and we'll have some fun. Let's move on to another story which you've highlighted for us as well. Spain's only department store reaches a deal to refinance its debt.
Yeah, the El Corte Inglés. So it's actually the department store monopoly of Spain. There's not really a competitor which could actually explain some of its financial problems. It has about 5 billion euros in debt, and it just reached an agreement to refinance about 76% of that, which is about 3.8 billion euros, which actually paves the way for some redevelopment. It's a much-needed redevelopment, in my opinion. The department store has been struggling, mainly because of its food, its kind of supermarket sector, has actually had quite a lot of competitors kind of coming up and being quite successful in recent years. So their profits have actually fallen because of this. So they've gone from about 716 million in 2007 to only 210 million last year, which is causing a lot of problems. And there is talk of a massive redevelopment. Some kind of changes have been made. They've been redeveloping their food courts, kind of turning them into this gourmet experience. Whole floor is called the Gourmet Experience. It's actually quite good. So it's one of the first kind of new things that the Corte Inglés is trying, and they've done it quite well. So hopefully they're going to try to implement the kind of same strategy on the other floors of the department store.
Because there are 83 department stores, but lots and lots of different parts of this network, aren't there? I mean, they've got convenience stores and all sorts of things.
Yeah, and also pharmacies. It's a huge network. If you look at their property portfolio, it probably explains their ability to reach this agreement on refinancing their debt. They've got about 18 billion euros in property, and they're all in prime locations. So the Corte Inglés does have a good starting point to kind of reclaim and get its profits back into the black, but they really are kind of outdated. So they've been kind of bringing in a lot of brands into their floors and trying to really update their whole look, but it's not there yet. So hopefully we're going to see some change in this space. I would like to see a competitor to really kind of kick them up the butt, if you will. But I don't think we're going to see that with the economics crisis at the moment.
Liam, we're going to leave you to go and experience some bad busking and to stay clear of those potholes. Thanks very much. That was Liam Aldous, our man in Madrid.
Now, in just a moment, we'll be leafing through this morning's Italian front pages with David Pleasant. But before that, here is I Gatti Mezzi with Fra l'Aeroporto e la Stazione.
Portami nel deserto onde a sentire ser cappello e fa buono anche te. Portami nel deserto onde per vedere se ti vi.
What a great song that is. Perfect song for a Wednesday morning. That was
I gatti mezzi with fra l'aeroporto e la stazione.
Oh, well, that is the voice of David Pleasant, because he is here to have a look at the papers. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin and Phil Hahn. So David is joining us in the studio to tell us what's making the headline in the Italian peninsula.
Good morning, Georgina.
Phil, I'm here
and
too.
And Phil, hello, Phil. I'm ever so sorry. Let's start with, as always at the moment, Berlusconi is making a lot of the front pages. This time he's gathered the nearest and dearest of his party for the first time since his conviction at the beginning of the month, the kind of inner sanctum of the PDL. And he's making some kind of quite disquiet, really. He's making some threats, basically. He's saying he wants some answers from the coalition government or there will be trouble. There'll be a crisis. The answers are basically what to do over the status of his political career, whether he'll be a senator or not, whether he'll be disqualified. So he wants to know straight away, and he's giving this kind of 10-day ultimatum to the coalition.
And interesting, Berlusconi came out a couple of days ago for the first time and made some comments about kind of his situation. And he said, quote, "I'm resisting."
Well, he's kind of, I think he's doing the kind of martyr act. He's really digging, setting his heels in. He is kind of saying, but I mean, the closest in the party are kind of rallying behind him. Fabrizio Cicchito, one of the ministers in the party, said that, you know, the centre left has to expect some trouble if they've been so behind this conviction of the Mediaset company that Berlusconi owns.
And of course his daughter is taking up the mantle.
Well, that's speculated. We don't know yet what she's refused. She's said that she won't, but a lot of people are speculating that she might, and she seems to be the most likely candidate. But in what way she might do that, whether it's head of the party or otherwise, we're not quite sure. But the Berlusconi era is certainly not over quite yet.
Lots to continue to follow there in the saga of Silvio Berlusconi. David, are you a fan of bears?
Yeah, they're cute.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think. Well, they're not actually
except
that cute.
Except when they want to eat you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We're talking about the animals, by the way.
I realise that. Thank you, Phil. The story that I'm going to be talking about now is in La Repubblica. It's called The Battle of the Bears. This is a battle between Switzerland and Italy. Switzerland, southern canton in Switzerland, has told Italy, the Italian National Parks Authority, to deal with its evil bears, directly translated, or mean bears.
No one likes a mean bear.
Yeah, it says, please, apparently there's been a statement, shoot down your dangerous bears, otherwise we'll do it ourselves, says the Swiss canton to the Italian Parks Authority. This is a result.
Does that mean Swiss bears good, Italian bears bad?
Well, bears unfortunately don't have a nationality, so they are able to cross the borders as they wish. So that's the root of the problem, really. That Italians have been taking part in a repopulation program, especially in the Trentino region, and they've got the population up quite considerably. Apparently, there's 34 cubs that are not accounted for, and they're roaming the valleys and mountains of the Alps. And if they stroll into Switzerland, which has a different repopulation program, they're likely to come into trouble.
So I'm guessing there's some obvious seriousness. There's concern that these bears could potentially be attacking livestock, potentially even going into campsites, I'm guessing.
Well, exactly. And that's kind of well documented by this very in-depth analysis of the bear problem in La Repubblica. It's listing all the different attacks and emergencies that have been caused by bear incidents. There have been 37 emergency situations in 2012, and they include attacks on farm property and even on humans.
Scary stuff. Sometimes I feel like we might have a bear problem here in London. Just walk down the street in Soho.
I thought you quite enjoyed the bear problem.
No,
actually.
Not a fan of the bears. Let's move on, though, David, to La Stampa. The elixir of long life, perhaps, has been found.
Yes, and I know we're all looking for that. Some American and Italian scientists have, specifically from the University of Boston and Center for Centenarian Study of New England, have found a gene that is believed to be to lead to longevity. This is called the FOXO3A gene. This has been linked to what have been deemed super centenarians, and those are people who are over 110 years old. People in Japan are more likely than anywhere else to have that gene, and also some people in certain regions of Sardinia and southern Italy, where there are more super centenarians than anywhere else in the world.
Well, including Berlusconi, possibly.
Exactly.
The man appears to get younger, or certainly his girlfriends do, by the day.
He may well have this secret gene. Who knows?
Well, it's interesting, because so many of the oldest people that have been around, have lived 110 years plus, many of those people have been from Japan, haven't they?
Exactly. In fact, there's been some interesting study done by La Sapienza University in Rome. And Italy is a kind of center for super centenarian studies, because it has had so many super centenarians, along with Japan. Apparently, Japan has 36,276 super centenarians. That's people over 110.
Well, here's hoping that one day we can all reach that very special milestone as well. David, thanks very much. Really enjoyed the bear story. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilias Simos. And our studio manager was Alex Afano. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.